This is A-State Connections on KASU. I'm Jonathan Reeves. This is the weekly segment called A-State Connections and Create at State, making connections that count. In this segment, you'll hear a couple of presentations from the Create at State Virtual Symposium in April. And these presentations are from the College of Sciences and Mathematics at Arkansas State University. First is Grant Dawson with his presentation, Are the Turtles Stressed Too?
Just like you and I, turtles are able to experience stress, not by impending deadlines, but by parasite loads, predator-prey interactions, and other stressors in the wild. When stressed, turtles will release glucocorticoids, a class of bloodstream molecules that have an effect throughout the entire body, specifically to promote the mobilization of sugars to use to respond to the stress and mediate physiological trade-offs. They also shift their immune system resources, changing the relative amount of heterophils and lymphocytes, two types of white blood cells, in their circulatory system. By increasing the relative amount of heterophils, turtles are able to bolster their frontline immune defenses to fight off the possible source of their stress. In reptiles, we find that these responses to acute or intermediate stress are very individualistic, dependent on how much chronic or continual stress the organism is usually under. A fairly unstressed individual can mount a robust stress response, while a chronically stressed turtle will generate relatively weak stress responses due to energy limitations. This is known as allostasis, or adjusting to a new normal. In this study, I wanted to determine if a population of turtles is experiencing chronic stress due to the water quality of their habitat, such as temperature, pH, conductivity, and dissolved oxygen. I measured the blood glucose level of turtles as a proxy for the amount of glucocorticoids released. Blood was taken and analyzed to establish a heterophil lymphocyte ratio. This is both indicative of chronic stress in wild animals, as well as shifting immune resources. Together, these metrics will indicate how robustly the turtle is responding to the stress of being caught by researchers, which we can use to infer how much chronic stress the turtle is experiencing. Over two weekends, I sampled turtles with the Newman Lee Lab from three locations at a runoff site of the Langueil River near Cherry Valley, Arkansas. 12 turtles were caught using a hoop net, and their blood was taken from the caudal vein three times, 0, 30, and 60 minutes after capture. The blood was tested with a glucometer and smeared onto slides at each of these intervals. The slides were fixed in methanol, stained, and analyzed under a microscope for heterophil and lymphocyte frequencies per 50 white blood cells. Water temperature, pH, conductivity, and dissolved oxygen were measured after each capture using a handheld calibrated device. The results show no correlation between overall change in blood glucose level and the water quality. However, there were positive correlations between blood glucose level and pH and temperature. Heterophil lymphocyte ratios and blood glucose levels both generally increased over time. Figure 3 shows a surprisingly tight correlation between the pH of the water and the baseline blood glucose levels. This is a novel discovery that isn't easily found in the literature, though we hypothesize that it could be due to physiological or ecological factors. Turtles have extremely flexible blood pH levels, which allows them to increase or decrease metabolic production. The level of pH in the water may help to increase metabolic rate. The pH could also be a reflection of limnological factors such as primary productivity or eutrophication. In Figure 4, the positive correlation between baseline blood glucose and temperature is due to the ectothermic nature of reptiles. This means that they cannot create body heat, so they must utilize outside sources, which dictates bodily functions like movement and metabolism. As the ambient temperature increases, the turtle's metabolism increases, causing the amount of glucose in the blood to increase as well. Figure 5 shows that heterophil lymphocyte ratios increased over time after capture by an average of 5 heterophils per lymphocyte. Each line on this figure represents an individual turtle, illustrating that as the turtles experienced stress by being caught by researchers, they began increasing their populations of heterophils. This figure shows that some individuals have a smaller increase in ratio over time than others. These turtles with a smaller change in ratio are likely chronically stressed. Therefore, they have less energy to devote to shifting their heterophil lymphocyte ratios. The individuals with a much greater increase likely have enough energy to do so because they're relatively unstressed. With a variation of increases in ratio, we can assume that this sample of turtles is variably stressed. Figure 6 shows all blood glucose levels increased over time by an average of 42 milligrams per deciliter. The uptick in glucose is caused by a host of physiological factors such as the release of glucocorticoids. According to Newman Lee et al. 2019, glucocorticoids aren't as connected to blood glucose levels as once thought. However, the combined efforts of glucocorticoids and other compounds such as norepinephrine provide a considerable link between stress and blood glucose levels. Therefore, we can conclude that all these individuals experienced acute stress upon capture. This turtle likely has an artificially high blood glucose level due to having a recent meal. Recent meals could also affect the relationship between blood glucose and temperature, which we need to control for a variable in future experiments. In summary, with these data, we can conclude that the turtles are, in fact, stressed too. However, this probably isn't from the water quality metrics we tested, and further studies are necessary to consider other variables, such as climate change and anthropogenic influence. Thank you to Mason Fisher and the Newman Lee Lab for their help with data collection. Thank you to Jen Terry for allowing me to conduct this study parallel to her thesis, and thank you to ABI for funding this project.
And that was Grant Dawson. Next is Brooklyn High School senior Nathan Stevens. His presentation during Created State was Mapping Transcription Factor Interaction in Soybeans.
The soybean is an important crop for the U.S. It carries rich nutritional and economical value. By studying transcription factors and their interaction with each other, helps us understand the gene expression of the proteinome in a soybean. The study of their transcription factors is very important because it allows us to generate superior plants in the sense of defensive productivity. We are focusing our project on defense-regulated transcription factors and their interactions during gene regulation. In Figure 1, we can see that the transcription factor binds the binding site and helps the gene to regulate, eventually to produce a different protein. In Figure 2, you can see how two different proteins are interacting with each other to bind to the DNA to express that gene. And in Figure 3, demonstrates how molecular cloning works. This figure shows how we can insert the gene of interest into the vector, which will transport the gene of interest to the competent cell and multiply vectors when cultured. Vectors are DNA plasmids found in bacteria. The goal for this project is to establish a protocol to study the protein-protein interaction between defense-regulated transcription factors and our interest. Specifically, our objectives for this project are to clone genes into GST and HALO tagged vectors and define 8 protein-protein interactions between these transcription factors. We began by extracting 8 open reading frames from our soybean, and then it was cloned into our donor vector using BP cloning method. Now we call this donor vector an entry clone because it has our gene of interest. These entry clones were then transformed into E. coli and were cultured in LB plus kanamycin media. Since this vector is resistant to the kanamycin, it will allow cells to grow in this media. After the incubation of the media, colonies of PCR was done to detect the clone vector and gel electrophoresis. After this step, plasmid extraction was done from the positive colonies. The inserted gene in the entry clone was then transferred to the destination vector using LR cloning. Since the vector is resistant to carbacillin, they were cultured in LB plus carbacillin media to ensure growth of the cell correctly inserted with the destination vector. After colony PCR and purification, we sent these plasmids for sequencing. After getting our results, we compared our sequences with a database using BLAST. This is our entry vector that we used. This is our destination vector that we sequenced with our genes of interest. In Figure 4, we can see the results of our gel electrophoresis. This showed us that the colonies were good for the sequencing. In Figures 5 and 6, we can see the BLAST results that showed us the GST tag and open reading frame were inserted into our vector and were aligned with good score. Looking into these results, we conclude that the open reading frames were cloned and in the vector, and the results were good. In the future, we are aiming to detect transcription factor interaction using the wheat germ extract, followed by the pull-down assay for our final detection. In this step, we'll be tagging our protein with both GST and Halo tags. Finally, I want to thank 2020 Young Exceptional Scholar Program for this opportunity and the funding, Arkansas State University and Arkansas Biosciences Institute for the facilities and support. Thank you everyone for listening to my oral poster presentation. I hope you have a nice day.
And that was Grant Dawson. Next presentation you hear is from Raghib Hassan and his presentation on Arecadin 3.
Around 40% of the hospitalized coronary patients develop ARDS, which is caused by lung inflammation due to the virus infection. Because of the inflammation, fluid and immune cells are going inside the lung alveoli, resulting interruption of gas exchange, which causing breathing problem and patients needed ventilation to breathe. Unfortunately, almost 50% of those ARDS patients are dying based on the current research. So lung inflammation is causing death in this case. Chronic inflammation can also cause and help to progress many other diseases like heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, etc. Even though there are few anti-inflammatory drugs available, scientists are constantly looking for more targeted, improved, and less side effect containing drug candidates. If you look closely among the anti-inflammatory drugs here, the latest one is Selexip, which was invented in 1995, more than two decades ago. Resveratrol, which initially found in red wine and later also found in grape, peanut, and blueberry, showed wide range of health benefits, including anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer activities. However, because of faster metabolism, it has limited bioavailability. Arachidins, which found in peanut, had similar backbone of resveratrol with an extra 5-carbon chain called prenyl group. Collaborative research from our lab found that because of prenyl group, arachidins are potentially more bioavailable, can inhibit virus replication, and can also bind with the cannabinoid receptor. Some literature is also suggesting anti-inflammatory effect of arachidin. However, the exact molecular mechanism of anti-inflammatory effect of arachidin yet to discover. Our lab uses peanut hairy root system to produce these arachidins. In this project, we will elicit, extract, and purify the arachidin 3 from the peanut hairy root medium and check its anti-inflammatory effect in cell line and rats. Our overall goal is to dissect the potential anti-inflammatory role of the arachidin 3, and the hypothesis is that arachidin 3 has better anti-inflammatory activity than resveratrol. After elicitation and extraction of the peanut hairy root culture medium, arachidin 3 was purified using HPLC method, which later has been used to treat the cell lines. Cytotoxicity and cell viability has been checked using CellTox Green Cytotoxicity and Real-Time Glow Empty Cell Viability Assay, respectively. Cytotoxicity assay results showing that 5 and 2.5 micromolar concentration is not toxic compared to the vehicle control 0 micromolar, which is the orange line. Similar to cytotoxicity, there is no effect of cell viability in lower concentration of arachidin 3 treatment compared to the control. Later, ALPS-induced inflammatory cells were treated with arachidin 3 and found that arachidin 3 significantly reduces the pro-inflammatory cytokine IL-6 production compared to the control. NF-kappa beta signaling pathway plays a crucial role in inflammation, and many drugs are specifically targeted for this pathway. Inhibition of any major molecule in this pathway can reduce inflammation, specifically inhibiting the translocation of the RAL-A, which is also known as the P65, can hamper the pro-inflammatory cytokine production. So we did some computational analysis, which suggesting that arachidin 3 has a stronger binding affinity for P65 and IKK. To test that, we have used immunofluorescence-based imaging technique and found that arachidin 3 inhibits the translocation of NF-kappa beta P65 complex and also the HMGB1. These results suggesting that arachidin 3 acts as an anti-inflammatory compound by regulating the NF-kappa beta signaling pathway. We have also conducted proteomics from UMS proteomics core facility, where ALPS-induced inflammatory cells were treated with arachidins and resveratrol as a positive control. And an animal pilot study on rats have been conducted in collaboration with Dr. Rajagopalan from NYIT to have better understanding of anti-inflammatory functions of arachidins. These experiments are ongoing and data need to be further analyzed. In conclusion, we have found that lower concentration of arachidin 3 is safe and it functions as an anti-inflammatory agent by inhibiting the RAL-A complex translocation into the nucleus, which eventually reduces the production of IL-6 and reducing the inflammatory responses. For further experiment, we will use Western blotting and other molecular techniques to check how arachidin 3 affecting other key proteins such as IKK and I-kappa beta in this pathway, and further animal testing will be done for better understanding. Here is the references that I have used. And I want to thank everyone for the research support, including the funding agencies. Thank you so much.
That was Rakita Son. Final presentation is from Nicholas Credick, and his presentation is titled Effective Pasture Land Use on Sub-Watersheds of the Buffalo National River in Arkansas.
Just a little bit of a background. The Buffalo National River was designated as an extraordinary resource waterway by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality in 2008. And it earned this designation due to its primary and secondary contact activities and because it is economic resource to local municipalities. Of the sub-watersheds of the study, 51 to 68% of the land surrounding them is forested, while 16 to 28% of the remaining surrounding land is used as pastures. It is a known fact that runoff from pasture land has both direct and indirect negative impacts on water quality parameters, such as pH, dissolved oxygen, nutrient loading, fecal coliforms, etc. Objectives of this study are to measure water quality parameters of each sub-watershed and identify differences in water quality at the headwater and outlet site of each sub-watershed, and in the end to determine if sub-watersheds meet Ozark Highland State water quality standards. To do this, we took once weekly samples at the headwater and outlet site of four different sub-watersheds, these sites being Bears Outlet Creek, Brush Creek, Calf Creek, and Tomahawk Creek. To get this data, we would use a bucket to collect water, and then in the field, we would measure parameters such as pH, temperature, conductivity, and dissolved oxygen, and flow. And then when we got back to the lab, we would analyze the data and the sample for turbidity and total suspended solids. Through the analysis of data collected, we found that for the parameters pH and conductivity, every sub-watershed has a significant difference between the upstream and the downstream sites, except for Tomahawk Creek. Though for conductivity, the only site that had a significant increase between the upstream and downstream site was Calf Creek, with an increase in conductivity between headwater and outlet, while Bear Creek and Brush Creek both had a decrease in conductivity between the upstream and downstream sites. Analysis of turbidity showed that Bear Creek and Brush Creek were the only sub-watersheds that had a significant difference between the upstream and downstream sites, even though the turbidity decreased on a downstream gradient for both of those sites, which we are currently trying to come up with a reason why that may have happened. But at the same time, Brush Creek was the only sub-watershed with a significant difference in total suspended solids between the upstream and downstream sites, and as in the case of turbidity and conductivity, there was an actual decrease between the upstream and downstream site. This is an ongoing project, and we are still analyzing nutrient data and counting fecal coliform data, and we'll continue to do so for the duration of this project. So more data may become available and may change our overall outcomes, so we will see what happens there. But as of right now, I would like to thank my partners in this project, which are Dr. Jennifer Bolden and Jesse Brown, along with our funding for this project, which comes from the United States EPA and the Arkansas Natural Resource Commission, and as well as the National Park Service for their assistance with locating the sites and keeping the roads clean and accessible so that we can continue to get to our sites and collect data. So, thank you for listening.
And that was Nicholas Craddock with his presentation. To hear more of the Credit State Podcast, you can always subscribe to the Credit State Podcast at the Credit State Podcast page on KASU.org. It's also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find the Credit State Podcast. Take KASU with you wherever you go and listen to podcast segments on the brand new KASU app. Just type in the search term KASU app in either iTunes or Google Play to be able to pick that up. And also, please tell others about the Credit State Podcast. Consider leaving us a 5-star review. That really helps get the podcast out to more ears. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. This is Credit State's podcast on KASU. The following commentary on KASU comes from Dr. Jonathan Berman. Dr. Berman is an assistant professor of basic sciences at New York Institute of Technology's College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. NYIT is an underwriter of KASU.
Why the wait? Over the years, Hollywood has given us numerous pandemic-themed television shows and films that typically conclude with the hero developing a treatment at the last moment that is rapidly adopted. As a result, humanity is saved in an instant. Unfortunately, we're living in a reality that doesn't mirror the big screen. As the public has learned, it might take 18 months or longer to develop a vaccine for the virus that causes COVID-19. Many have wondered why the process takes so long. Vaccines must be safe and effective before they're ready to be delivered. Although the speed of development for many vaccines has increased significantly, it still takes many months for them to reach approval. Why be so cautious? It's a lesson learned through trial and error. In 1901, a horse named Jim was used to produce serum containing diphtheria antitoxin. However, Jim contracted tetanus and died. Nonetheless, Jim's serum was distributed and traced to the deaths of 12 children, all of whom died from tetanus. As a result, the government saw the need to become more involved in the process, and the Biologics Control Act of 1902 was implemented to regulate biological products such as vaccines. Later, the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 added regulations. Since then, quality assurance has been folded into the Food and Drug Administration. Other incidents followed in the effort to eradicate polio. In the 1930s, two teams worked to develop vaccines. One was led by John Colmer of Temple University, and another by Jeremiah Milbank and Maurice Brody. Their vaccines were each tested in thousands of children. Between the two vaccines, a number of allergic reactions occurred, resulting in the deaths of 6 children and the paralysis of 10 others. The public outrage that followed these deaths arguably set back vaccine research by 2 decades. Later, when Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin developed their polio vaccines, another incident occurred. Salk's vaccine used inactivated poliovirus, which means the virus was killed by treatment with formalin so that it could not infect cells. Cutter and Wyeth Laboratories improperly inactivated more than 100,000 doses of polio vaccine. In this case, the vaccine contained a small amount of live virus, which caused polio infections and resulted in 250 cases of paralysis and 11 deaths. The Cutter incident led to greater oversight of vaccine production and testing. Although these incidents occurred almost 100 years ago, we still take stock in the lessons they teach. Like any other drug or biologic that will be administered to many people, vaccines must be tested thoroughly to ensure their safety. As the previous examples show, a lack of precaution can have unintended effects, and that precaution takes time. It cannot be rushed. The process has become much safer, but also much longer, as researchers are required to adhere to more and much-needed regulations. Vaccine development begins with exploratory research, which develops a protocol for producing a vaccine. This might be through inactivation of a virus, the attenuation of a live virus, weakening it so it causes an immune response that doesn't infect a host, or other methods. These experimental vaccines are often tested in cultured cells, living cells grown in dishes, to make sure that they don't produce infections. Next, these drugs are typically tested in living animals because no culture mechanism adequately replicates the immune system of a living animal with all its complexity. These tests look for safety, and in animals vulnerable to infection, may look for the generation of immunity. This initial development and testing can take years or decades of continual iteration or refinement, although several strong COVID-19 vaccine candidates are already past this stage. In clinical trials, vaccines that have proven safe and produced immunity in animal trials will first be tested for safety in humans. Here, increasing doses of vaccine are given to a small number of human volunteers to determine a safe dose that does not produce significant side effects. This is called a phase 1 trial. in a phase 2 trial, a vaccine that has passed phase 1 without causing significant side effects will be tested for effectiveness. For example, a group of people vaccinated against SARS-CoV-2 might be followed for several weeks to determine if they are less likely to test positive for SARS-CoV-2 than those who have been vaccinated with a placebo. These trials provide additional information about safety. Phase 3 trials scale up testing to hundreds or thousands of patients. Following rollout of a vaccine, further studies are conducted to ensure that it does not cause additional problems that weren't previously noticed. Each of these stages often takes months or years. Occasionally, the FDA will fast-track approval of a drug for an urgent unmet medical need if the results are extremely promising, such as with the development of Gleevec, a common cancer medication. Currently, hundreds of trials are ongoing for either vaccines against the virus that causes COVID-19 or for treatments that might lessen the severity of its disease burden, such as antivirals or convalescent plasma. We've already experienced the risks of rushing treatments in this pandemic, as studies have found that hydroxychloroquine, which was initially touted by some as a treatment for COVID-19, seems to have no benefit and increases the risk of death. We must be cautious that when a vaccine does become available, it's been proven to be both safe and effective. Patience is a virtue that does not come easily in our world that is accustomed to immediate gratification, but it's one that must be practiced as we let the scientific process play out.
The preceding commentary on KASU comes from Dr. Jonathan Berman. Dr. Berman is an assistant professor of basic sciences at New York Institute of Technology's College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. His book, Anti-Vaxxers, How to Address a Misinformed Movement, will be available September 8th. NYIT is an underwriter of KASU.